I don't know if we can still depend on it, but I think there used to be a time when most people would have at least known some details about this story where Jesus multiplies the loaves and the fishes. It's almost, at least for us, and maybe in the West in general, that we know these stories because they're just told all the time. You know, we're familiar with the story about Jesus multiplying loaves and fishes, even if, like I say, we don't know all the details. I don't know if we can depend on people knowing that story anymore, but we're going to look at it today. He feeds here 5,000 people with a few loaves of barley and some fish. Later on, he will feed about 4,000, again with a very small amount of food. And we don't know if there were other times he may have done the same thing. These may have been the most notable that the apostles gave to us. Maybe they were the only ones, but whatever the case, it's a pretty good miracle, to say the least. Each time we see these miracles, there was teaching and there was healing involved. And so I'd like for us to look at them today, and let's see if we can learn from these stories today. And I want to do something a little bit, I don't know if I want to call it unique, but maybe different. I want to try to look at these from the perspective of certain individuals involved, and maybe one individual not so much involved, but I'm going to make him up because I think he's going to represent part of what is involved here, and that's the crowd. What I want to do first, however, is I want to just give you the references to all of the different accounts of this particular miracle and just kind of note some of the differences and similarities in the way each of the disciples actually portrays them. This particular miracle is given to us in all four of the gospel accounts. So it must have been a very significant one. Certainly it must have left a very strong impression on the disciples. They felt like it was important to pass this particular one on to us. The first time we see it is here in Matthew chapter 14, verses 13 through 21. Originally, as we have this, it seems that it was an attempt by Jesus to actually get away from the crowds. Jesus, in this particular occasion, tells the disciples, "You give them something to eat." They don't have enough to eat other than 5 loaves and 2 fish. There is no mention of the boy here in Matthew chapter 13, which we'll see in another account. But we're told that they sat on the grass, and there's a very interesting detail. And I'm not quite sure why this detail is given, but it's given in 3 of the accounts. Number one, it was grass. Mark says it was green grass. And I think Luke or John says there was much grass in that place. Little detail that seems insignificant, but it's got to be there for a reason. I'm not sure what it is. I just believe it's there for a reason. We are told that they recovered 12 baskets full of leftovers, as opposed to what they had originally had. We are told also here in Mark, or rather in Matthew, that there were 5,000 men besides women and children. Now that's a very interesting detail. Very interesting detail. I'll come back to that when I talk about John. Mark chapter 6 is Mark's account of it. It says in verse 34 in Mark chapter 6 that he taught them many things. So it's fairly clear here that the reason he was there was not just to heal, not just to provide them a meal, but was teaching them about the kingdom of God. This particular account in Mark mentions that one of the disciples notes 2,000 denarii couldn't feed all these people. Now, 2,000, well, a denarii was about a day's wages. So we're talking about several months' worth of money here wouldn't have fed all these people. And again, Mark 6, they sat on the green grass. Detail, I'm not sure why, but it seems to be there for a reason. Luke chapter 9. This one follows an account or a comment about Herod, but this one does not mention the death of John the Baptist. All of the accounts, I believe, except John, note that there was this thing that happened with Herod. Herod was kind of questioning, what's going on? Who is this guy? What's happening here? And he says, I know I put John to death, so it couldn't be John, or maybe it's John come back to life. And Mark and Matthew both use that occasion to tell us about the death of John the Baptist. Luke doesn't mention that. The occasion still seems to be the same. Luke gives us a location. He says, it's near Bethsaida. It would have been around the Sea of Galilee. John 6, I believe, provides some of the more interesting details here. Because in John chapter 6, Jesus actually tests one of the disciples. It wasn't like he says, okay, just go give them something to eat. He tests Philip and said, you know, why don't you go get something to eat for them? And apparently, according to John, John says, well, he was doing this. He knew what he was going to do, but he was just kind of testing Philip to see what Philip would do here. Also in John, Andrew plays a role here because Andrew is the one who finds the boy with five loaves and two fish. And by the way, all four of the accounts give exactly the same details of how much food they have. Five loaves, two fish. John notes that it was a young boy that had this food. And it was Andrew who went to find him. So Philip and Andrew, by the way, are going to be two of the people we're going to look at this through and just see. In John chapter 6, after this occasion is over, after the miracle is finished, the people clearly identify Jesus as the prophet. And that's a prediction way back in the book of Deuteronomy by Moses that there will a prophet arise like me from among your people. Listen to everything he says. They see the miracle of the food. They assume correctly that Jesus is the prophet. They assume incorrectly that he's going to be a king in a way that they assume that is a military commander, like David was. And so in John chapter 6, it says they sought to make him king by force. But Jesus escapes. Jesus just leaves the place. He gets out before they can actually do that, and they can't find him. Now, what's interesting about that little detail is you go back to the idea, and John says the same thing. There were 5,000 men. No, that's not counting women and children. It's very possible that what they were counting there was fighting men. And they are going to go make him king by force because the Jews believe that the Messiah, the prophet, is going to go and he's going to start an armed rebellion and he's going to overthrow the Roman government. Well, their understanding of the Messiah was a leader like David. He was the son of David. So it makes perfectly good sense to them that he's going to be an armed leader and he's going to destroy all their enemies and he's going to make them to be, how should I say, the top dog? They're going to be the rulers of the kingdom of God. But that's not what Jesus wants. And so this occasion, I believe, is a time that they really felt like the rebellion was going to begin. The miracle indicated to them that this was the guy, but they had the wrong reason. So what I'd like to do here is take a look at this from three different perspectives. You know, it's very interesting, isn't it, that when we all come to class, come to church, come to read the Bible, we all come with our own perspectives. We all have certain experiences that guide the way we think. We all have certain personality perspectives that guide the way we think. And that's not saying any one of them is right or wrong, but we all have those perspectives. And we have to, in our own perspectives, kind of find what's meaningful here. We also have to be able to see the truth of what actually is going on. And why should it surprise us that when we look in the Bible and we look in the New Testament, we see people with different perspectives coming at this and going, I don't really get this, or coming, wow, I really believe this. You know, why should it surprise us when we see all these different reactions to Jesus? Let's just take a look at it from a couple of different perspectives here, and maybe we can identify with these people and maybe learn something from their own perspective. Let's start, shall we, with the boy and his food. The boy and his lunch, I believe, it was sometimes portrayed. We're going to call him Joey, just to give him a name, so that he's not just some nameless feature to this story, although he kind of is. But let's talk about Joey. Now, we're going to look at Joey's perspective here after the fact, and after he's already gone home, and he's talking to his mother. This is later in the day now, okay? The occasion is already gone. Joey's back home, and he's talking to his mother. And the interesting thing here is Joey has brought home what he took. He did not, well, she's going to think, perhaps, he didn't eat his lunch. And Joey sits at the table, and he starts talking to his mother. And she says something like, weren't you hungry today? Oh, yeah, I was hungry. I had plenty to eat. She's looking over at the food he's brought home with him. Well, what did you eat? Did somebody give you something else? Yeah, kind of. Well, where did you go today? Well, I went over and listened to this guy that they're calling the prophet. Okay, I've heard about this Jesus fellow. What were you doing over there? I was just listening to him. Well, what was he doing? He was talking. He was teaching. He was healing. He was healing, huh? Oh, what did he heal? Well, and he goes into some detail about what he sees, perhaps. How close he'd gotten to all those healings, we don't know. We're using a little imagination here. He was there, and I'm sure he saw something that impressed him, not the least of which is he tells the story about how Jesus took this food of his, this one disciple. What was his name? Oh, his name was Andrew. He told me his name. Andrew. And Andrew did what? Andrew took me over to Jesus. And what did he do? Well, he took the food that I had. You just gave it to him? Yeah. And what did he do with it? Well, he fed 5,000 people with it. He fed 5,000 people with 5 loaves and 2 fish. Yeah. You know, I don't know what his mother was thinking at this point, but either she's thinking, well, my boy Joey is a good kid. He wouldn't lie to me. Or he's saying, Joey, are you telling stories again? You know, she's obviously a little suspicious. She sees the food. She can't deny that he's still got food. She says, well, would you like some dinner? No, I'm not hungry. I had plenty to eat. But you didn't eat your lunch. Oh, I had plenty to eat. He made enough for all of us. In fact, he had some left over. That's what this is. She's just like, some point in the discussion, his father comes in. His father's going to play a role here. We're just going to use a little imagination, but his father plays a role. He had not been there, we're going to assume. But he had heard about the incident. He'd heard about everybody in town talking about how this Jesus had multiplied food so that they had plenty. They were all out in the field, and he knew why they were out there. They were out there because, okay, the Messiah's here. We're going to start an insurrection. He didn't want to play a role in that. So he stayed at his job, whatever his job was. Maybe it was fishing. Maybe he owned flocks. Maybe he was a merchant or something. We don't know. But the boy can only think about what he saw and heard. Whatever his mother says, whatever his father thinks about what he did, all he can know is, look, I know what I saw. I saw the miracles. I saw people who were sick. Well, were they really sick? Yeah, they were pretty sick. And Jesus healed them. Yeah, Jesus healed them. And then he took your food and he gave it to the 5,000 people. Yeah, that's what happened. I'm sorry, but I can think of his mother and father going, I don't know about that. You know? But anyway, there's Joey. He's seen all that. Well, then there's his father. And let's let the father represent the crowd. Even though he wasn't there in the beginning. And again, we're putting an imaginary character into the story, admittedly. But these people are there somewhere, aren't they? We know that everybody's talking about this. And we know that other people had to hear about it. And we know that other people had to at least be wondering what was going on. And we're going to suggest that his father was intrigued, not so much by the miracles or by the teaching, but by the abundance of food. And so he didn't want necessarily to be a part of an armed conflict to overcome and overwhelm the Romans. But when he heard about the food, he was like, well, gee, maybe I should go and try to get some more of that. I won't have to go to work every day as much, at least. So he goes the next day and he catches up with Jesus. Let's just imagine that he's a part of the crowd that catches up with Jesus the very next day. Oh, and we're over in John chapter 6 and verses 24 and following. That was part of the passage that was read this morning. They got into a boat, they went after, and they found Jesus in another place. And what he hears the next day is Jesus, instead of speaking about food, he begins talking about eternal food. It's kind of not really what he expected. And maybe he's a little disappointed because he comes home that day empty-handed. Jesus doesn't just provide food for them that day because that's not what Jesus is trying to do. And he actually has a fairly strong rebuke for that particular crowd. And so the father goes home empty-handed and probably disappointed. Certainly perplexed at what he heard, which we'll get to in just a moment. But then we have the third group, And we're going to call them a group, but we're going to look at it through two guys. And that's Andrew and Philip, the disciples, the immediate group, the inner circle of Jesus. Andrew and Philip are the two real players in this whole thing. They're the ones that are mentioned in several of the passages. Jesus tests Philip, we're told. Andrew finds the boy with the food, we are also told. And we have to kind of sit and wonder, well, what did they think about the miracle? Philip had been tested, and he may be thinking, how wrong could a guy be? You know, how can we provide food for so many people with only five loaves and two fish? Well, he did somehow manage to do that, and it's like, you know, Philip's probably going away shaking his head. It's like, wow, that was pretty cool. Certainly bewildered by the whole thing and at what he had seen. I kind of wonder what might have been a conversation between Andrew and Philip may have been later on. Andrew, what were you thinking when you went and got the boy with the loaves and fish? I don't know, I just found some food. Maybe I thought, you know, we were going to eat that food and he was going to send everybody else away. Well, you know, did you at all anticipate what he was going to do? Well, of course I didn't. And did you, Philip? No, I didn't. He asked me to get him some food. Well, I was just trying to help you, Andrew says. I think these two disciples may represent all of the disciples, and that's what I think is significant here. Well, what do you think they learned? They were there. Did they take anything away from this? Did they learn anything? Did this experience mean anything to them in such a way that it changed the rest of their lives? Well, the boy. How about that little boy? And we're going to say he was about 12. We don't know that, but it just says it was a boy with five loaves and two fish. And we called him Joey. So what did Joey think when he left? And he left with more than he had when he came. Or at least he left with what he had when he came. And he saw that what he had when he came fed 5,000 people. When it probably was maybe just enough for him and one or two other people. I don't know how much he would have wanted to eat. What do you think he felt when he saw all those healings? And he heard Jesus talking. Now all that's before he multiplies the loaves and fishes. He was obviously a little boy that was intrigued enough to be there and follow. He was one of the women and children, you know, one of the non-counted individuals. And yet, he sees something that had to have left a deep impression on him. Could he have learned that with Jesus, all things are possible? Could he have learned that if you give, you'll receive in return? Could it be that as a 12-year-old, maybe he couldn't even think in such sophisticated terms yet, or didn't care to think in such sophisticated terms, but he just went away with an impression that, you know what, I will never forget this as long as I live. I kind of think a 12-year-old boy would at least get that much. Wow, I've never seen anything like that. I've never seen a guy perform miracles and teach like he did, even if I didn't understand it all. You know, I understood a little bit, but then he took my lunch and he fed 5,000 people with it. Sorry, a young boy's not going to ever forget that. And maybe that's all he needs to take away from it. Well, we put his father in there. And we kind of said that his father is going to represent the crowd. Okay, and again, I used a little bit of imagination. But let's just say you're his father. And you went because his son came home with a lot of food. And he said, food is good. We need food. Let's go get some food. Okay. He reduces this to the most basic and barest of motivations. We need to eat, so I'm going to go get us something to eat. But then he gets there, and in John chapter 6, he hears Jesus say this. Truly, truly, I say to you, you are seeking me not because you saw signs, but because you ate your fill of the loaves. Now, you know, it's almost the first thing out of Jesus' mouth when he sees this crowd who has come from the day before. And again, maybe his father, maybe a few other hangers-on who said, hey, we got a source of food here. And Jesus immediately rebukes them. Immediately. And we should not think this is just some mild rebuke here. I think Jesus is really hitting on an issue that is at the very heart of who they are. And we'll see as we go through John chapter 6 in a couple of spots how this really strikes a raw nerve for them. And Jesus tells them, don't work for food that spoils. And if I'm the father, I'm sitting there, well, how am I going to feed my family? Isn't that what I have to spend all my time doing, working for food to feed my family? I'm a responsible adult. I'm caring for the people that are under my roof. And I want you to think for just a minute about the kinds of people in the audience, in this crowd, and their particular attitudes. I think there's a sort of multiplicity of motivations, just like there is with all of you. And with any crowd, there's a different motivation sometimes for different groups. And I think there are several we can probably figure out. One is, there are those who spend all their waking moments seeking material goods because they think that's the highest good. Or they may even just recognize it's a responsibility to provide for my family. Not a bad motivation. Jesus still offers that rebuke. There perhaps are those who know how to work the system and get food and things out of other people. There are those, perhaps, who seem to think that life, and insert here others, the government, civic or religious groups, any other organization should provide for them. And maybe even those who are envious of what others have, and so they're there to just sort of get their share. See, at the very heart of this, though, Jesus is challenging this materialist philosophy or this materialist view that makes things the highest priority, that makes self-preservation the highest priority. When Jesus speaks of bread from heaven giving life to the world, they say, well, give us this bread to eat. You guys remember what the woman at the well said when Jesus was talking about living water, that she thought, well, I won't have to come here to this well every day to get, and she says, give me this water so I won't have to keep coming here to draw water. Isn't it interesting that all the modern conveniences that we have to make life better really hasn't necessarily made us better people? It's made things a lot more convenient. I can go into my kitchen, I can turn on the tap, and I can get fresh water. You know, even if everybody likes to buy bottled water, that's still pretty good water compared to what it used to be and the way we used to have to go get water. You don't have to go to the well. You don't have to go draw it out. You don't have to boil it to make it good water unless something happens. My point here is Jesus really hits a raw nerve with people in this particular occasion. And I'm going to demonstrate to you how they respond. In verse 41, they grumbled. In verse 52, they disputed. In verse 60, they couldn't listen anymore. They said, who can listen to this? And in verse 66, many of them just left. This was radical talk. This was Jesus saying, look, I'm not here just to provide food for you. I'm here to provide eternal food for you. And the work that you're supposed to do to get that food is to believe, basically, he will say, in me, I am the bread of life. That's what Jesus says about himself. So what was his father thinking in all this? I think his father may have been one of those people. There certainly were many of them. And maybe he was just one who just went home disgusted, went home disappointed at the least that he didn't get a handout, didn't get some food. He got something deeper than that. He got something more important than that, but really just didn't want it. It was too weird for him to talk about, you know, I am the bread of life. You know, if you partake in me, you'll have eternal life. Oh, that just, I don't get that stuff. So he leaves. One other group, the disciples. when given the chance to leave after all of this, in John chapter 6 and verse 68, Jesus turns to his disciples and said, well, are you going to leave too? And I think Peter speaks for the disciples, and I'm guessing for Andrew and Philip, and says, well, who are we going to go to? You have the words of life. Later on, in Matthew, this time in Matthew chapter 16 and verse 6, Jesus warns them about the leaven of the Pharisees, and immediately they're concerned about bread. Verse 7 of chapter 16. But Jesus wasn't talking about bread, and he assumes that they have a faith problem because they should have remembered that bread was not really that important. I can provide plenty of bread. Now, this is even beyond the time that he's fed not only 5,000, but 4,000. And they're still talking about, well, we haven't got enough bread. Jesus is like, what is wrong with you? I can make as much of that as I want. It's not about bread. It's about the teaching of the Pharisees. But it was for them a faith problem. That's why they misunderstood it. That's why they couldn't get to that deeper issue. Things that bring eternal, not just temporal life. They couldn't get beyond those things. And Jesus keeps trying to draw them to that. I think there's some conclusions that we can legitimately draw. Maybe you have some more that you can draw. Here are the ones that I thought of. Number one, seek first the kingdom of God, and all these things will be added to you. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 33. If you make that your priority, Jesus can take care of the rest. He may not do it quite the same way, but he will do it. Matthew chapter 4 and verse 4, Jesus has already put in his mouth, man does not live on bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Could the crowd have learned that? I think that's kind of where the disciples got to, even though they're just sort of, they're probably feeling a little alone because there was a large crowd and all of a sudden it's just them. Maybe more than the 12, but there aren't many of them left. Most of them have stopped following. But they had to really learn that man does not live on bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. I would suggest also that we should learn that believe in Jesus, who is the bread of life. That's what Jesus was really trying to get the crowd and the disciples to do, was have faith in him. And you see, belief is not just an initial confession. It's like a daily devotion. It's something that's a part of your life, something you do every day, something you do regularly. Your commitment to Jesus follows that, as is a life consecrated to God that follows that. I don't know what lessons you learned from it, but perhaps there's some insight you have that's made this a very significant event for you. But I hope it continues to be a significant event as you remember that Jesus himself is the way, the truth, and the life. Eric?